Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Smith, the Honorable Judge Kevin Ross presiding.
Thank you, and welcome to this third oral argument of today's calendar, May 19, 2022. And for the record, I will just indicate what all the parties and the judges are aware of, which is that we are not live in court today. We are handling today's proceedings by Zoom interactive video. Having said that, we are, despite the fact that we can see each other and we can see each other's names, we're only making an audio recording of the proceedings. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, so those who are listening to the argument in our archives are able to attach the lawyers to the right parties and the right arguments. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. And with that, I'll just also mention that so far today, we've been mostly technologically clean. We had a couple of minor glitches, but if at any time during today's proceedings, anyone has any difficulties seeing or hearing anyone, or there's any, you notice any freezing, somehow just try to bring it to our attention and we'll just pause things and try to let the technology catch up to us, or we'll try to catch up to the technology. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Sally Silk, and I represent the appellant Vistendahl, Morse, Dorsey, and Hahn. Your Honors, this case is about the improper application of Minnesota probate statutes to Vistendahl's liens and claims for attorney fees. Vistendahl is asking this court to make it right, to correct the errors of the district court by reversing the November 2021 order for the following reasons. Minnesota statute 524.3803 requires that a claimant, that is a creditor, file a claim within 4 months of the time that they've completed their work. Vistendahl did that. 524.3806 requires that the personal representative must disallow the claim within 2 months, or it is automatically allowed. The personal representative did not disallow the claim. 806 next requires that if the personal representative wants to change his or her mind before paying the bill, the personal representative must petition the court for additional time and show good cause for the delay. This was not done. In our case, on these facts, the statutes require that the claim is allowed. Period. End of story. The end. That is how these probate statutes operate. Moreover, the nature of the claim makes no difference. It doesn't change the application of the statute, whether the claim is for attorney's fees or personal services for a decedent or
just
medical.
So I'm clear. Yes. Your view seems to be, without regard to the issue of standing, are you suggesting the district court lacked discretion to limit attorney's fees to what the district court felt was reasonable, that if there's no option whatsoever, unless the personal representative stands in and says it's disallowed?
That is what we are saying. However, I can also say that the reasonableness analysis is not triggered until an objector who has standing, or until a party who has standing, objects. And in this case, we are arguing that the foundation did not have standing to object. There are other ways for—
And just to be clear, I mean, just as a matter of general standing, aside from the question that you're focusing on with regard to the language in the statute, you don't dispute, do you, that the foundation has a stake in the outcome of the court's decision as to attorney's fees? That is, since the state was the remainder holder in the trust, that if there was an excessive amount of attorney's fees, for example, or if the trust otherwise had its assets depleted, that it would have an effect on the foundation's remainder. You agree with that, I assume?
While I agree that it is a potential beneficiary along with four other charities, at least at the time that the foundation filed its objection, it is important to understand that the foundation...
Well, you mentioned in addition to four other charities, but this is the one that's the primary one. I mean, the other charities don't come into play unless there's some failure of the trust to dispose of the assets according to the trust language, direct language. Do you agree with that?
I agree that the foundation is the only party that has objected here, but whether it has standing to object is a different story. The foundation is not a beneficiary of the estate. The foundation is a beneficiary of the trust only. The trust
But as I understand it, Ms. Silk, the estate is going to the trust, and the trust has two beneficiaries. I mean, I keep looking at the broad definition of interested person and wonder, you know, if the foundation isn't an interested person, who would be?
The trust would be an interested person, Your Honor. The trust is the estate beneficiary, and the trust is the residuary beneficiary of the estate. And what should have happened here was that the foundation, under the trust statutes, should have gone to the trustee and said, I need you to object. I don't like Vista Doss claims. And at that point, it was the obligation of the trustee, because after all, the trustee is a protector of trust assets. They are the voice of the trust. Their job is to protect the trust assets. The foundation should have gone to the trustee, asked them to object or demand that they object. And if the trustee does not object, then the foundation can go to court and ask the court to compel the trustee to act, compel the trustee to object to Vista Doss fees.
Isn't that form over substance? I mean, you're acknowledging that the foundation has a stake in the trust. You're acknowledging that the trust has a stake in the will, in the estate distribution. And there's a direct line between the two. If the foundation has an interest in the trust, why doesn't it necessarily also have an interest in the estate?
Because it's not a beneficiary of the estate.
I understand the linguistic and the mechanism issue that you're raising. I'm, as a matter of what courts generally consider as parties interested in the outcome of a decision, isn't the foundation, in that general sense of interested person, a party of interest in the estate?
If we concede that it does have standing, as you say, Your Honor, there's still the problem.
I'm just asking questions. I'm not.
I understand. I think the issue is that, so let's say a trust has 40 beneficiaries. They can't all go on their own and start filing objections with the court. The only vehicle for resolution is to go through the trustee.
The case law that supports that proposition, let's say there aren't 40, let's say there are three. In this case, there's one, but let's say there's three. You're saying that that they can't individually raise the objection. I'm just wanting to get a sense of, outside of the statute, are you aware of any case law that's interpreted the statute in the way that you're asking us to interpret it?
Not on the trust statutes offhand, Your Honor, but the trust statutes are clear that it is the trustee who has the obligation to represent the interests of the trust beneficiaries. There is no question about that, and there's no getting around it.
But isn't that a separate question than whether the foundation is interested? I mean, I don't read this statute to say there can be only one interested party, but that seems to be your argument.
Well, actually, the trust, any party who wishes to object to the fees needs to go through the trust. And they could do that in the trust matter, and they can do that in the estate matter. For example, if the foundation wants to object to an action taken by the personal representative or an action not taken by the personal representative, in this case, the PR did not disallow the claim, the foundation still has to go to the trustee, who then has to go to the personal representative. That is the whole point of these statutes. The probate statutes are very clear about method and process and clarity. That is the whole point of the Minnesota Probate Code, which is modeled on the Uniform Probate Code, to provide a procedure for carrying out a decedent's intent.
Let me ask this. In terms of the court's authority, would you agree that the court can review all bills that are submitted in an estate sua sponte for reasonableness?
Well, that's a very good question, Your Honor. Vistadal actually did submit all of its bills the foundation objected.
But without an objection, couldn't the court determine whether fees are reasonable or not?
Only if the objecting party has standing to object.
Couldn't a court, without objection, determine whether fees are reasonable or not?
They could, except in this case, the claim has already been allowed. And so the time to determine reasonableness is over. It has expired. There can be no reasonableness analysis now. And actually, early on, Vistendahl did ask the district court to allow a Rule 412 review of its fees. And Rule 412 says that you can bring in a neutral fact finder to review an attorney's fees. And the rule also says that the estate can pay that neutral fact finder for that review. And typically that neutral fact finder is another attorney, or there are actually firms or companies that do this kind of work. But in our case, the district court said in the November 2021 order that it was denying Rule 412 review because of the cost and because Vistendahl had not stated exactly how the review would be paid, which is puzzling because the statute provides an answer. It says that it can come out of the estate. It was not the job of Vistendahl to propose another way to cover that cost. So,
and who is the personal representative at that point?
It's been Greg Fiorentino. That is Greg Fiorentino has been the personal representative from the beginning.
Mr. Vistendahl represented Mr. Greg personally, yes, as well, right?
No. Vistendahl only represented Greg as the conservator and the personal representative. Another attorney represented Greg Fiorentino individually in another matter, unrelated to this probate matter. And that matter is the litigation matter that we have discussed in our motion to strike, where we said those documents are not related to the probate matter and were submitted for an improper purpose. But no, Vistendahl never represented Greg Fiorentino individually.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, yeah. Ms. Silk. You point to Section 524.3806 to support your argument that because the personal representative did not object to the attorney's fees, that the court had no ability to weigh their reasonableness and adjust them. But yet another part of the probate code, the probate proceedings 525.491 and 525.515, in fact, direct a court to apply a five-factor analysis to, you know, to attorney liens filed in the context of probate proceedings. Wouldn't those more specific provisions of the code govern and take precedence over the general allowance of claims provision?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you for that question. That kind of review should be taken prior to the expiration of the statutory period, which would result in Vista Dahl's claims being automatically allowed. And the case law is clear that if a personal representative affirmatively fails to disallow a claim within the 2-month statutory period that they're given under 806, and that is after the 4-month claim period has closed, that means that the claim is allowed. And there, that is unambiguous. And the Peterson v. Marston is the seminal case on that, Your Honor. And it's also been construed to mean exactly the same thing in Estate of Francis, which was a case decided by this court in 2005. There is no way around the fact that the claim has been allowed. However, 806, to your question, Your Honor, does provide a mechanism for the personal representative to disallow late. 806 says, okay, if the disallowance period has expired, and the claim is automatically allowed, the PR can still come in late and ask the court to consider disallowance, but they have to show good cause at that point. That hasn't been done. The personal representative has not come in to object to the claim at any time, not during the initial 2-month statutory period and not during the follow-up period that is provided under 806. And so we are left with a claim that must be allowed. And we see the court discussing it in Peterson v. Marston and Estate of Francis, where these courts say the claims must be paid in full. That is how they work. I mean, if we were a hospital and we were seeking payment of our medical bills after a decedent died, the hospital would be entitled to all of their fees unless the personal representative followed statutory procedures to disallow, none of which was done here.
Thank you. Your time has expired. You will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you choose.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Tom McElstrom with Collins and Buckley here in St. Paul on behalf of the respondent, the James J. Fiorentino Foundation. A little bit of context, if we can, with respect to this appeal. The context of this case, as the court can tell from the materials, is the referee Olson in Ramsey County Court said, enough is enough. The attorney's fees that had been presented in that relative to the conservatorship were very, very large. And the court can see from the detailed order dated October 10, 2020, that the court was very troubled by these ongoing onslaught of attorney's fees. And so what they did, of course, is he capped out any further fees. And what did the appellant do? The appellant did not want to go back to referee Olson and ask for him to reconsider, to submit additional billings and get him to change his mind. There was no appeal. What did they do instead? In March of 2021, they improperly served a notice of attorney's liens, which is entirely improper, and they were called out on that improper move immediately by the foundation. Ultimately, Security Bank and Trust, the co-respondent, also objected to that. So that's the context here. They're trying to backdoor this claim, and they're trying to avoid referee Olson scrutinizing their fee claim. The question was asked, I believe, by Judge Smith, what if nobody had objected whatsoever? And the answer is, it's still court review. And it's interesting to us because one of the cases that's cited in these materials is this rock star, Prince, and the estate of Nelson, which was recently up to this Court of Appeals. And what does the case say? What does the Court of Appeals say in the Nelson case? It says over and over again in that decision, attorney's fees When it comes to those, the court has broad, broad authority in all matters attorney's fees. So we have that premise, and then we go to the next question. And the next question is, does the statute that they're citing that they say automatically gives them approval of their fees, does it actually say that? And of course, the answer is no. The easy hypothetical, of course, under their logic is they submit a bill to the personal representative and they have an hourly rate, let's say it's $1,000 an hour, or let's say it's $10,000 an hour. And their position is, well, if the personal representative doesn't do something about it within a certain period of time, then guess what? The claim is automatically allowed. On the face of it, it's nonsense. But even more so, the statute that they're citing for this, it doesn't actually say that. If you look at, and I think the question was asked by the panel, what statute should be applied? I found it very interesting when they originally started with an attorney's lien in March of 21, and then what they do, they get to May 17 of 2021, and they appear to change their tactic because they were called out on the bad faith filing that they had made. The law is crystal clear. If you're a law firm, you're seeking fees in connection with these estate matters, you're supposed to proceed by motion. The general rules of practice, Rule 119, makes it crystal clear. If you have a claim for fees, and by the way, these are new fees. They've already been capped by the referee and they have a whole bunch of additional fees, then how come they simply didn't proceed by motion? So we call them out on their notice of attorney's lien, which is wholly improper. And by the way, they agreed in the hearing ultimately that they would withdraw the liens. They then proceed with this motion on 5/17 of 21. They file a petition for an order directing the personal representative to pay the claims. And by the way, the foundation objected to that timely. Security Bank and Trust also joined in the summary judgment motion that we brought and joined in the objections. And Security Bank's position on this was, why don't you simply go back to the referee where the jurisdiction lies, the probate court? And that was the basis for Security's position. But let's go back to the statutory analysis that they're advocating. They say in their May 17, 2021 petition, they cited, as has been called out, 524.3806. That's the general claims statute. And the question we have, and this is the Prince case once again, in Re Nelson, there's a specific statutory provision. And the specific statutory provision is 524.3721. But let's go down the pathway for a moment of 806, the general claims statute. So what does it say in that statute, subdivision B? It says, upon the petition of a claimant in a proceeding for the purpose, the court may allow, not shall allow, may allow in whole or in part any part of the claims presented. If you go to subdivision A of that statute, 806, what does it say about the failure of the personal representative to mail notice to a claimant within this two-month period? It says it has the effect of a notice of allowance. It doesn't say has the effect of an allowance. It has the effect of a notice of allowance. And so what we have here over and over again is things have to be reviewed by the court and they have to be reasonable. And if they had simply followed the statutory language in 524.3720 and 524.3721, you'd see over and over again in those two statutes, 720 is what we would call the gateway statute. And it says in 720, it says the personal representative who incurs expenses such as legal expenses is entitled to receive from the estate necessary expenses and disbursements, and then it says, including reasonable attorney fees. And at the end of 720, what does it say? It says, the attorney shall be paid compensation from the estate, and here's the language, as the court shall deem just and reasonable and commensurate with the benefit to the estate from the recovery so made from the services. So that's the gateway statute, 720. And then the following statute is 721. This is the very specific statute. And this is the one, by the way, that was discussed in the Prince case, in Re Nelson. What does it say in 721? It says, after notice to all interested persons. And then I find it very interesting. In the first line of that statute, 721, it says, or on appropriate motion, if the administration is supervised. And then it looks at the engagement of an attorney. And what does it say? It says the reasonableness, not the per se fee claim submitted, but the reasonableness of the compensation may be reviewed by the court. And so what we see here, we think, is a misdirection on the part of the appellant. 721 provides for review of their attorney's fees. And what I find interesting about the statute language is that language at the first line, which says, or on appropriate motion. And the question over and over again to the appellant here is, why did you simply not proceed by motion? And we know the answer. Rule 119, once again, of the general rules of practice requires a motion. Why didn't they do that? And the answer was, referee Olson said, no more fees. You're capped out. And as the court can see in reviewing this case, the appellant is not the least bit interested in talking about standard of review, abuse of discretion. They make it very clear in their materials. They don't want to talk about the judge's decision, whether he abused his discretion, anything like that. And
well,
the reason
I think that in fairness, that's because they're making a legal argument that there is a threshold problem with the district court's approach, as opposed to a challenge to the reasonableness assessment of the district court. I think that would be the reason why they're not making an abuse of discretion argument. They believe that they can, well, perhaps that's the only way, but they believe that's the best way for them to succeed.
Fair enough. If that's the case, our response is the statutory provisions that they're citing and the burden on them to proceed by motion, which they never did. But the statutory language, to your point, Judge Ross, it doesn't say that. It simply doesn't say that. And so from our standpoint, this was always going to be an end run. And what they complain about, of course, is due process as well. They say that as part of this whole appeal, that they were denied due process.
I had a question about that, because your position seems to be they should have brought a motion. And they didn't. They filed these lien notices instead. But you kind of end up at the same place. Everybody who wanted to make an objection apparently did. You end up in court, and as I understand the record, the district court said you're going to have a hearing, and then didn't in fact permit the appellant to have a hearing. And you get a motion hearing, right? If you ask for the hearing, so why isn't there, why doesn't their due process argument prevail?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. First of all, we know from, for example, the Supreme Court Matthews v. Aldridge that an evidentiary hearing, an oral hearing, is not always required. It should be flexible to fit the circumstances. But we set forth in our brief over and over again how many times this issue of their fees was briefed and it was argued. And there was a motion before the judge in July of 2021, referee Olson. And indeed, I think that their position is, well, we were supposed to have a further hearing on this after some time passes. And there's a number of things I'd like to say about that. First of all, do the statutes that are involved, do they require an oral evidentiary hearing? And the answer, of course, is no. The next question would be under the Rule 119, which is how you're supposed to submit a claim for fees. Under Rule 119, there is no language that says you get an evidentiary hearing, and it talks about very specifically in Rule 119 what is supposed to be submitted in written form. Our co-respondent, Security, the Counsel for Security, pointed out something interesting that I had never noted before, which is in the appellate rules, rules of appellate procedure, again, there is no if a person is seeking attorney's fees in an appeal, there's no provision for an actual evidentiary hearing. So our position on the due process argument is, number one, have they ever just told us, informed us, convinced us that what was the thing that they would have done, the thing that they would have said or done had they been allowed yet another hearing on this. And they've never done that. And then again, the statutes, the rules, they don't provide for a hearing, an oral hearing. And I think we cited a couple of cases in our materials, a recent decision by the Minnesota Court of Appeals here, Lansing versus Wells Fargo, Minnesota Court of Appeals 2021. It says, when we talk about the rules governing motions, summary judgment motions, dispositive motions, they refer to hearing process, but they don't refer to an oral hearing. Affidavits, written arguments, as the Court of Appeals here has held, satisfy this issue of due process. If there's any questions on due process, I'll field them further. Otherwise, just very briefly on standing, I think the questions have largely been asked by the panel here. It just seems to us that it could not be more clear on the interested person analysis, 524.1-201-33. And I think the referee noted that said every payment made by the estate reduces the foundation's share. 524.1-201 defines interested persons, as has been pointed out. It specifically provides beneficiaries and any others having a property right. And I think the referee Olson, his response to the idea that we lack standing, or perhaps even Security Bank lacks standing, he found that to be silly. That's not the word necessarily that I would use, but it just doesn't make any sense that somehow the foundation nor Security Bank and Trust would have any standing to object to the fees that are being brought here. And so as I see my time is dwindling a bit, I just sort of like to come back to the circle, which is they seem to be saying, without the statute actually saying that, statutory analysis requires approval of their claim for fees, no matter what, no matter what the amount is, no matter what the hourly rate is. The statutes don't say that. And the law is very clear that the court, and this includes the Nelson decision, the court has very broad discretion, very broad jurisdiction to decide all manner of fees. But if we stay on their statutory argument that those statutes, and again, we think the specific statute for fees must control here, the statutes do not in any way say what they claim that they say. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll stop here.
Does not appear as if any of the panel members have any further questions. So thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, there's a lot to cover, which I don't think I'll be able to do in the next 5 minutes, but
just for the record, go ahead and start with your name for us.
Yes, I'm sorry. Sally Silk for the appellant, Mr. Dunmore, Dorsey and Hahn.
Thank you,
Your Honor. So Mr. McKellenstrom is wrong. The case law construing 806 absolutely says that on facts that are identical to what happened in our case regarding failure to disallow, that means that the claim is deemed allowed. Those are the words that are used in Re Estate of Francis, which construes the seminal case Peterson v. Marston, number one. Number two, standing.
And just to be clear, your argument is, to put a fine point on it, you say those claims are allowed, I think you're implying, comma, without regard to reasonableness.
That's correct, Your Honor. At this point, that's correct, because the statutory period has expired. If we allow the reasonableness analysis to come in, when would there be an end to things? One of the points of the probate statutes is clarity, is to provide closure, is to provide a clear process for examining claims, for example. Which brings me to another point. I know counsel was just stating that why didn't we file a motion and our liens were improper. All of that is wrong. We're no longer an interested party in the estate and conservatorship matters. We withdrew from representing Greg Fiorentino as conservator and personal representative in November 2020. we were no longer an interested party in that case. We had to file an attorney lien and claims. We are now a creditor. We do not represent Greg anymore. And that is exactly what we did. We filed our attorney lien. And of course, an attorney lien only provides notice. It doesn't provide anything more. And basically, it's meaningless without the other half, which is the written statements of claim. And when the court dismissed our lien against the trust that Mr. McAllister was referring to, we believe that was improper. We had told the court we would be willing to remove that lien against the trust so long as the court did not find it improper. But the court went ahead and did it anyway. I believe they did it the very next day after the hearing. However, that said, it does not affect our ability to recover our full amount of claims because we still have a lien against the estate and a lien against the conservatorship. And the statutes are clear that if there's not enough, there are not enough funds in the conservatorship estate, then you look to the probate estate, the estate. If there are not enough funds there, you look to the trust to pay your fees. The statutes are clear about that. And in fact, Referee Olson has already ordered that when we were to receive some fees several years ago, that they should be paid from the trust because the estate no longer has sufficient funds. Another point to make about the trustee who Mr. McAllister does correctly say that the trustee objected to the lien. The trustee may have objected to the lien, but the trustee never objected to our fees. And that is specifically on the record. At the July hearing last year, Referee Olson specifically asked the trustee, do you object to their fees? They say they do not object to the fees, but they object to the lien. They made that distinction clear. And so we have a trustee who we are arguing is the only party that has the power to object here or to represent the interests of the foundation. They have not objected to our fees. Now, I do want to address standing because I think it's very important. As far as the reasonableness analysis goes, how can a reasonableness analysis take place until a proper objection has been made? And we are arguing that the foundation did not have standing to object. Among other things, the district court strained to find standing for the foundation. What did it do? It said that the foundation had filed a Rule 11 motion for sanctions, and wasn't that the same thing as a notice of disallowance? And this is in the order, Your Honors. This is, I don't remember the page number, but it's in the conclusions of law. I think it's maybe paragraph 10. The district court specifically said that the motion for sanctions is the equivalent of a notice of disallowance. And therefore, the foundation could come in under 721 and it had standing. That is obviously a problem. There is no statutory law, there is no case law that allows anyone to substitute in for a personal representative. Why should the foundation be allowed to override the decision-making authority of a personal representative or of a trustee? That's essentially what the court is doing. And I should add, not only did the district court allow the motion for sanctions to basically decide this case, that motion for sanctions was withdrawn by the foundation. The foundation had mistakenly filed the motion for sanctions without giving Vista Doll the required 21-day safe harbor period. And when...
I've let you go a bit over, your time has expired some time ago, and the arguments you've made, I think you've made previously today, but also in brief, and we have taken into account and will continue to take into account all of the arguments presented by those parties arguing and of course, from the co-respondent. Thank you for your arguments in brief and for your oral arguments today.